Thank you to all the panelists for being sprightly and provocative. We are going to go to 12:30, so there's going to be time for questions from the audience for sure. But I had one question I wanted to roll down the length of the panel. I wanted to ask about eureka moments. Was there anything that any other panelist said that caused you to say, eureka? In other words, I have an idea. The light bulb went on in your head, and you said, ah, we could do something about that.
I have one, yeah.
It could be something you said, of course, but I'd rather it wasn't.
No, in David's talk last night, that remarkable slide that showed if we take a section of boreal forest and we can either treat it as an amazing asset that has lots of value, or we can treat it as a factory to produce toilet paper. And historically, we've been doing the latter, but I think we need to increasingly recognize all of the values. Some we can measure, some we can measure poorly, some we can't measure, and recognize that. I think that was a remarkable insight.
Okay, anybody else?
Well, what strikes me most is because we are such big water guzzlers, it is so easy to reduce consumption.
Yeah.
And I don't know why we can't do it. I mean, it won't cost you anything. It's a slight behavioral change. You're not going to suffer if you have 30% less water use. So I cannot understand why the public just cannot buy into this.
But you live in Vancouver, right?
Yes.
So how much? But you didn't save anything by saving water.
Well, Vancouver
your water bill didn't go down.
Vancouver is not even metered.
Well, so, you know, other than being a good person, why would you do it?
Trying to show leadership because if I shout, I better show that I have something to back it up with.
So, when you mentioned low flush toilets, as I thought about this, we just have had programs both in the United States and Canada which amount to cash for clunkers. Mm-hmm. If you're driving an old car that's polluting more, we'll pay you to upgrade it. Is there any reason? I mean, I know nothing about economics, which is why they chose me to moderate this panel. Is there any reason why a cash for clunkers program wouldn't work for 6-liter toilets? You trade in your 6-liter toilet, get a 3-liter or 1.5-liter toilet.
They exist.
Not in Ottawa. Maybe they don't.
They're isolated and they're across the country. Historically, low flush toilets have gotten a bit of a bad name because the engineering was problematic. My understanding is the current generation of flush toilets works much better, and there are programs in place where cities will give you a grant for that type of thing.
Well, we built 30,000 new houses in BC last year, and 15% put in low flush toilets.
Yeah.
We're missing the boat because if you build a new house, you're not going to change your plumbing for the next 30 years.
Yeah.
Why don't we have a mandatory national policy that every new house has to have it? It's not going to cost you anything.
Just put it in the code.
Yeah.
Okay, well, we have some roving microphones. And they're about to go roaming. There's some people right here. You should say who you are, and if you represent anything other than yourself, you should say that. And if it's for the panel, that's fine. But if anybody specifically, address it to them. Go ahead.
Tony Moss, director of the Freshwater Program at WWF Canada. My question is mostly for Stephen, actually. One of the things I don't think you spoke about in your presentation is elasticity of the pricing mechanism and thinking of it as a tool for water efficiency. And when I sit down with even my colleagues who work for a large conservation organization and tell them in Toronto that their water rates are going up by something like 9% a year right now, for the next few years anyhow, they have no clue. So it's not showing up on their radar in terms of their bill going up. So one of the things that I've always felt is that because we're starting at such a low level, how do we get around that challenge of even an increase of 10%, which might seem like a lot, but on a dollar value, you know, 10% of a little bit isn't a lot, right?
If I understand your question, the evidence shows that people respond to prices. If you raise the price of water, in the next month, there's a limited number of things you can do. You can shout out your kids to turn off the tap, but over the next year or two, when the plumbing needs to be changed, or when your company is retrofitting, then you make bigger changes. And, you know, the evidence suggests that, you know, a 10% increase in price all other things equal, will lead to, you know, a 6 or 7% decrease in water use over the long run. And more importantly, it's not just that people change their habits, but you get all those clever tinkerers and innovators and thinkers now thinking about new technologies, improved toilets and all these other things. And these now come on the market because people demand them.
Professor Brown?
Yeah, I just wanted to get into that just for a moment on the issue of full cost pricing. I think it's much more problematical than it seems, although I'm for higher prices. So I want to make that clear in the beginning. But in the case of full cost pricing, you're, of course, allowing harm to be done to ecosystems. You're just having to compensate for it, right? You're still, so that's one of the things you're measuring. And it's much sounder public policy, in my view, to set up constraints that can't, or barriers that can't be crossed in the protection of ecosystems, even if you're willing to pay the cost, and then set your price structure within those basically biophysically determined constraints. Also makes a lot less work for economists.
There, sorry, go ahead.
I'm Isabel, I'm a student. I had a bit the same question, but I wanted to know actually if you would put like the same price for residents and companies, taking in consideration that industrial and companies are the main users, and I think they're making a big difference while people are not consuming that much. So I think it should be it shouldn't be in the same boat. And I had a question as well for Madeleine. I was wondering about the withdrawal of water in the Freshwater Act. I read somewhere that companies were responsible of seeing how much water they took from groundwater and surface water. I'm just wondering, like, how do you control that? I know there's some parts of the government that are responsible for that, but I have a problem finding how can we trust that. We have to deal with like the goodwill of the companies. So I would like to have your opinion on it. Thanks.
I'm not sure that I understand the question, in fact. Can you rephrase it?
Sorry, I'm Francophone, definitely, so I have a bit of problem in English, but...
Moi aussi.
Ben, vous êtes francophone. OK. Ben, en réalité, c'est ça, c'est pour les... l'eau qui est prélevée par les compagnies. Vous avez dit, dans le fond, la loi qui est passée au mois de juin, il y a plus de contrôle qui est fait par rapport à ça, puis on a besoin de demander une autorisation de prélèvement au gouvernement, ce qui est déjà un avancement spectaculaire, c'est merveilleux. Je me demandais, au niveau du contrôle de ces prélèvements-là, j'ai lu, je me rappelle pas à quel endroit, mais j'ai lu que c'était en fait les compagnies qui étaient responsables de dire la quantité d'eau qui prélevaient. Donc, je me pose la question à savoir, faut se fier en fait sur la bonne volonté de la compagnie, à savoir s'il n'y a pas des abus à ce niveau-là. Je sais que c'est un peu complexe de savoir, mais je me demandais votre opinion à ce sujet-là. Merci.
Effectivement, c'est à chaque année, ou même est-ce que c'est deux fois par année, on doit faire rapport au ministère des quantités qui ont été prélevées. Mais la déclaration émane de l'utilisateur, mais elle doit être contre-vérifiée par un spécialiste. Donc, il y a un mécanisme, je pense, de vérification pour s'assurer de la véracité de la déclaration. Et on va venir éventuellement avec l'imposition de tarifs, pour, en tout cas pour les entreprises, pour les usages commerciaux de l'eau. Et ça, évidemment, à partir du moment où on a les données quant au volume de consommation, la question des tarifs, évidemment, va être beaucoup plus facile à mettre en place. Je ne sais pas si ça répond à votre question.
La différence entre ce qui était dit par la compagnie et ce qui était prélevé par la suite
c'est
par
tout
le gouvernement.
C'est tout nouveau, c'est ça, là, le rapport. Donc, il ne peut pas y avoir de statistiques, je crois.
Non, mais c'est les cas jusqu'à présent, en fait.
Pardon?
C'était les cas jusqu'à présent qui avaient été prélevés. Je pose une question, en fait, justement, c'est nouveau.
Non,
je veux savoir votre opinion.
Le règlement qui exige maintenant qu'on fasse rapport des prélèvements, et est entré en vigueur, qu'est-ce que c'était, septembre 2009. Donc, on n'a pas d'histoire encore, là. Mais il y a un mécanisme de contrôle. Est-ce que ça va être suffisant? Bon. Si un utilisateur fait des fausses déclarations, le ministère pourra mettre fin à l'autorisation, hein, et sans compensation.
Right there.
that gentleman.
Okay. Oh, just quickly.
I'm sorry.
To answer your prices follow from your objectives. You decide what you want to achieve in your prices, and then the price, actual level of price, follows from that. So you first have to decide what it is you want prices to do. Is it just to recover costs? Is it to encourage conservation? Is it to et cetera, et cetera? And so that's the general principle. If you presume that prices are meant to reflect costs, then if industry and residents have different costs associated with their supply, then they will face different prices. But if they don't, then there's no basis for difference. But you have to be careful. I believe in most municipalities, industries don't, in Canada at least, most households and industry are roughly similar. You may be thinking of industrial water use that's not connected to municipal systems, like large factories where it's a very large quantity of water. But that is provincial allocation permits, and it's a different issue about pricing those.
Well, I'll give you another example. One of my former PhD students is a hydrologist, and he got hired by Deloitte. He's the first hydrologist being hired by an accounting company. And his mandate is to have water accounting for industry. And I talked to him the other day, and I said, well, how are you faring? And he said, it is an incredible challenge because it never even comes up on the budget. Energy is way up there. Everybody wants to cut down their carbon footprint. Water, it's not on the horizon. So how do we bring this in an economic context? That's the big struggle.
I'm Andrew Osteen from the University of Guelph. I guess it's directed to you, Hansa, again. You were talking, it was really interesting was hearing about the rural communities that actually have an exorbitant amount of water that they use, 1,800 liters per day. I mean, that's shocking. And to know in rural systems, that goes right back into a septic system. That's even more shocking to me because that's what that's what my background is. I deal with wastewater that comes from rural areas. So how these people are on their own well. They have their own system. They are not connected at all to any larger grid. So how do you try to impress upon people that they're not only impacting groundwater reserves, but they're also could be polluting a high amount? If it's 1,800 liters a day, that's really, really a lot. So just your comments on that I would like.
Well, I'm going to be completely out of the political realm. I think BC is the banana republic when it comes to groundwater. We have no groundwater legislation. You can pump as much water as you want from your property, and you don't care what the neighbor does. And I think, you know, time has come when we have to bite the bullet, because we've now looked at rural areas and septic system density, and there's a really clear relationship. The closer your septic system is to your groundwater, you're going to have problems. And so this needs massive public education, and I think the biggest problem is why there's such a reluctance is it costs you a lot of money to drill your well. So you spend $15,000-$20,000 to drill your well, and then the government comes and said, I'm going to tax you. Mm-hmm. And that's not going to work, right? So we need to start from scratch, and we need flexible laws. This is an oxymoron. But if we don't allow flexibility within the law, we don't get innovation. And right now, the water laws are so bloody archaic, they always look backwards. And now we have climate change, which is completely new, and I tell all the lawyers, start thinking about the law, about climate change and water. That means you're going to have to think completely differently. How do you get the law facility, the fraternity to actually start thinking about this? Those are really interesting things we need to push.
No, just a comment on that. I completely agree, but if you have, you're going to have problems that come up over many decades, you're going to need a frame of reference that most legislatures and most city councils don't have. So that's an argument in favor, I think, of some sort of regulatory body like a public utility that regulates electricity or something, so that it has the mandate to look out over a very long period of time and manages good for the benefit of both humans and ecosystems.
Way back in the corner there, was there somebody? Okay. move down. Uncharacteristically for me, I'm seeing better on the right than on the left. So if there are people on the left who actually want to ask questions, okay, thank you. I haven't been spotting you very well. So now, go ahead.
Thanks. Hi, my name's Chris. I work for a local radio station, CKUT. I have a question about the full cost pricing of water. You mentioned that it wouldn't affect low-income households, but you didn't actually elaborate on how that would be done. I was sort of curious as to what measures have been taken in past projects.
It certainly could. If you just blindly go ahead and say, well, we haven't been looking at costs correctly, and hence we have to raise our prices, that would almost certainly have a regressive effect, because the amount of money that the households spend on water as a percentage of their income falls as income rises. So if you raise the price of water, it could potentially have a serious effect. One of the big complications is typically poor people, as a proportion, live more in rental units, and they don't tend to be metered. So there's that complication, you know, the connection between water prices and impact. But in general, there are a variety of ways that you can do it. One is so-called lifeline price structures, where a certain amount of water is priced below cost or even given for free. And that is, you know, you can figure out what quantity it is, but it's basically, this is the amount that people need. And we're just going to, as a group, say, look, we're not going to recover the cost on that. And then you may have increasing block rates after that, or some kind of inclining structure, peak load pricing, because peaks are generally generated by higher income people because they have more water using capital, that type of thing. So again, it's just a technical issue. You set your goal, which is we want to achieve full cost recovery, we want to promote conservation, but we don't want to change, for example, the water budget of the lowest 15-20% of the population. And then you just set your prices accordingly. So it's not, and as I said, if you look at the examples of Seattle and Los Angeles is probably the most interesting one, where they went through this exercise and they had community involvement, they had technical experts, and they sat down and as a group they decided that this was their set of goals and the result was this set of prices.
You sort of spoke disparagingly about having people in Alberta paying for the water if people in other parts of the country. And I was wondering how this sort of isn't another sort of cross-subsidization.
That was different. That was in the context of infrastructure grants. And what I was arguing there is that the common perception is that the federal government or perhaps the province gives money to the municipalities. That's not true. It's households that give money to households. It just works through the tax system. And so the infrastructure grant system is really just a way of some households in one part of the country supporting the water use and other types of uses of households. Now, that may be something that we as a society want to do, but I think it needs to be better understood. And more importantly, I think the grants need to be tied with performance conditions so that if we are going to put money into a city, that city needs to be showing that they're doing, you know, reasonable measures to reduce consumption rather than continuing underpricing, which is just continuing the cycle of needing more and more infrastructure money. I've had more than one mayor suggest anonymously that the game is very clear. You just push your system until it breaks down, and then you hope Ottawa saves you. It's not complicated, unfortunately.
Just put bore down here for a question, or core down. Shouldn't automatically people who have swimming pools pay a surtax? Whether, you know, for instance, in Britain, when you get your Ministry of Transport license for your car, it costs you more if you have a larger capacity car. Whether it sits in the garage and never goes anywhere, you pay more because you are more consuming, as it were. If somebody puts in a swimming pool, prima facie, shouldn't they be paying a surtax?
Well, it depends what you mean by surtax.
Extra water charge above and beyond anybody else's water charge.
If you don't like swimming pools and you want to punish that...
If you think a swimming pool is a huge body of water...
Well, I would argue that if you think that filling swimming pools in the middle of the summer is a costly thing, then the price of any water use in the summer should...
So it would be captured by that bimodal method.
I mean, it's not clear that, you know, my wife watering her garden in the middle of July is socially different from my neighbor filling her swimming pool. My wife would argue differently, but she's not here. And this is being taped.
But, and she grows vegetables too, right?
She does. But in any case, the point is pricing follows objectives. You decide as a collective, what are your objectives? What are you trying to achieve? Protect the environment, provide everyone with potable drinking water, provide enough resources so the system is financially viable and engineeringly sound, and provide incentives for innovation. And then you just work and say, okay, what are the prices that achieve our goals? And the key thing is our prices do none of those things right now. We're very, very clever in building systems. We're remarkably clever in chemically treating water. We've just gotten part of the equation wrong.
Hello, my name is Salma Nguyen, and I'd like to ask a question as a law student. As a law student who is thinking of going into environmental law, but who at the same time doesn't understand half of the scientific data and the economic vocabulary that has been presented throughout these last 2 days. So let's just put it this way. When Professor Schindler yesterday posted a slide with the legislator who's blind and who is going towards the cliff, maybe he is blind but unintentionally. Because when I read the Bill 27, the Water Act that Professor Quentin-Cumet talked about, and when I read about Res Communis, your article, to me it made sense. But now I realize that maybe it makes sense to me because it is legal. So now I take advantage of a situation where there's a panel with different specialties to ask, does it make sense to all of you as it does to me? I guess the underlying question is, when you are of different specialties, you sometimes have different frame of minds. And so as different people from different specialties, how do you mesh? How do you come to an approach of communication that will bring to effective solutions?
Professor Brown.
Yeah, I want to take it. That's a great question. I'm going to give two answers. One very simple. If you have a choice of a member of parliament or of the National Assembly who has a scientific background, unless he or she is an idiot in every other way, elect them. Because it's a big problem. Right. And the more complicated answer is I think that you've really hit on something that's a very deep structural issue, that if you look at the curriculum of a university like McGill and you think of it in terms of what paradigmatic worldview lies behind the curriculum, in many cases it's the evolutionary scientific paradigm, right? So certainly in the sciences you would have that in psychology, and many other disciplines are going to line up with the scientific paradigm. But many of the things that we study at a university like McGill are still embedded in a Judeo-Christian paradigm, which is the sort of root of our culture. And I think the things that are still embedded in the Judeo-Christian paradigm are the law, ethics, economics, and politics. And that one of the reasons we have very profound problems in our society is our ethical and normative systems have no systematic connection to our scientific understanding of the world.
You've been waiting patiently. I actually meant two in front, but this gentleman here had his hand up first.
Hi, Richard Lehan from the law faculty, working together with Peter Brown on this. I just wanted to underline one point that Peter was stressing in relation both to what Stephen and Hans have mentioned. Hans's question about why is something that is apparent not done is because it's not valued. The economic approach, as Professor Brown has pointed out, will only touch to a certain point the question of value. So I think I just wanted to stress again what Professor Brown was trying to work out, is that the shift in values has to be modeled both within existing normative structures, but also reach past them. So I think his assessment of not just finding practical solutions, which should evidently be implemented, but until certain things are simply actually taken out of our capacity to use them for immediate gain, only then do they actually take on the value that Professor Schreier is talking about. So we actually have to have in our social imaginary, our political imaginary, the ability to create those spaces. So I just wanted to once again underline that as much as the practical and the economic are systemically necessary, the value shift has to be modeled in an equally differentiated way. And that's why I wanted to support Peter Brown's initiative.
If I could just quickly respond.
Yeah.
One of the most interesting areas in economic valuation recently is the notion of an option value, that we go out and ask households whether they'd be willing to pay to preserve endangered species. And these are species that the average Canadian will never have any physical proximity to or personal contact with, blue whales and pandas. And it's remarkable, and every environmental NGO knows this, that large amounts of money are being paid out on a daily basis by people to support ecosystems and endangered species that they'll never see. And you say, why? And they say, because I place value on its existence. I place value on knowing that my children have the option 30 years from now of being able to see a great panda or a blue whale. And this really is surprising. And it really indicates that people have very deeply held beliefs and that they can communicate them in a way that through economic valuation we can point to policymakers and say, look, it may not be current consumption. There is value today on keeping it available for 30 or 40 or 50 years. And so what sounded like kind of pedestrian calculations have at their heart the types of things that you're talking about, I think.
You still, this lady here.
Hi, I'd like to offer not
you
just
are?
To the, oh, sorry, Myla Craig, and I'm with Melanie, and I'm an independent consultant on responsible and sustainable investing. So I'd like to offer a different sort of perspective to the panel, but also to everyone in this room. You know, I think we underestimate the power that we have as individuals. And, you know, if I ask the question, how many people in this room have a pension fund? How many people in this room have investment funds? Steve, thank you so much for bringing forward the whole full cost accounting. There's a movement in Canada right now which is responsible investing, and it's really trying to get corporations to come forward with transparency and accountability on environmental, social, and governance issues. And, you know, the environmental water, I mean, when you said 87%, someone today, one of the presenters, 87% of our water usage is for four industries in this country. How many of those companies are public companies in Canada? We own those companies. We as individuals in our pension funds. How many of us know if our pension fund has a responsible investment policy? That's extremely powerful. If we're asking those questions, our pension funds will put it forward. It will force the investment industry to move forward on this and ask the questions of the corporations to file the right information, measure the right information. It's not happening. We need it to happen. And, you know, it's one other solution. Obviously, there's many. But I think that there's a lot of power in this room and your colleagues, et cetera, to move forward. And I just wanted to present it. I just think there's a great opportunity here for all of us. And it's about asking the right questions.
Yeah, the code is CRS, Corporate Social Responsibility, and you'll find it in some annual reports. Banks particularly are twitchy about it. Back there, there was a question, was there not? Did you not have a question to ask?
Yes, I did.
Like 15 minutes ago?
Thank you.
Just take a while.
Thank you. Gail Kranzberg, McMaster University. Very, very interesting panel. Thank you. It's a very small question because the big questions other people have used up, so thank you. Why is it, can we go back in history, for those of you who are scholars of this, why does Canada have the lowest pricing on water anywhere in the world? Why? How did that come to be? What was the mentality, especially since we don't have the most renewable resources anywhere on the planet. That's been made clear to us. So what started this, and how do we turn it around?
You saw the figure earlier that we had 6.6, I think it was, percent of the... But what should have been on that same graph was what percentage of the world's population do we have? Why I think... We have that mind fixation is because per capita we have an awful lot of water in this country. Is it the highest? I figured it might be if you divide it into a mere 33 million people. So, sure, it's not a huge percentage compared to some other people, but they both have bigger populations than we do.
But water has nothing to do with it.
We're talking about a mindset here.
No, but the fact that it's the capital and the labor and the materials that are underpriced. I'm not even talking about putting the value of water into the equation. That's a whole other different step. It's just, why is it that municipal governments have so failed in their accounting? And I think it's possibly two reasons. One, water's not unique. I mean, our roads, a lot of our public infrastructure is improperly accounted for. You know, you can use almost every major highway in Canada for free. And so they're undervalued and overused. And so a lot of our public capital shares that characteristic. And it's also partially because for a long time, I think water agencies were just a simple department within a municipal government rather than a standalone utility. And if it were a standalone utility, it would have different cost accounting rules. It would have to report differently. You couldn't cross-subsidize. And so I think that was a big part of it, too. But you're right. It's just a strange thing that has arisen. And you look at other countries that have the same hydrology, the same population, and it's just been different.
So we probably have time for one more question and answer. Who has the most important question left to ask? You're absolutely positive you've got the most important question right there. The lady in purple gets a microphone.
Hello, I'm Penelope Ma, and I'm studying integrated water resources management at McGill University. And my very important question is, I have one and a half questions, but they're both, well, the half might not be, but the important question is, I'm wondering at what stage you think Canada is in terms of moving towards full cost water pricing. And are we at the beginning of a really slow change towards it, or are we even moving towards it? Or are we waiting for this huge bump of we need universal water metering first and then trying to move on from there? That's my question. And then the half question is for Mr. Schreier. And then you showed pictures of toilets. And then I was just, it made me think of like when automatic flush toilets came out, I just, sometimes it flushes like three times when I'm in there. And I was wondering what you think of, I'm wondering what you think of automatic flush toilets and water conservation and the whole automated like water things and everything. So,
well, I was feeling good until you asked that question. credit where credit is due. The final report of the inquiry on federal water policy, which is now essentially 25 years old, so you know, acknowledge them for what they did. They called for full cost accounting and full cost pricing, and it's taken 25 years. There is an initiative in the province of Ontario where it has now been written into law that this will be required. And what's remarkable is they decide to do it. You know, and you can't get anywhere, other than, of course, the tragedy of Walkerton and some of the fallout of that, they just decided to do it. And so, you know, we're Canadian. Every government spends half its time looking over its shoulder. And so hopefully the other provinces will see what happened in Ontario and follow their example. I know there's a lot of interest, although, you know, to be perfectly honest, Quebec is perhaps an exception in that regard, in the direction it's moving.
And regarding low flush toilets, where is Bob Sanford? He told me he bought this Niagara flush where it's transparent, so you see the water go down, right, when you flush. And he was telling me for the first months he used far more water than anything else because all the kids in the neighborhood wanted to see how it works. But let me assure you, Australia has gone through a complete evaluation of all the systems which exist in the world. And they have come up, if you go to their website, they have rated all the systems. Yes, there were early problems. Today, it's no longer a technical problem. And it's not a cost problem either. It's actually cheaper than a conventional toilet. And just as an add-on, the Capital Regional District in Victoria has this replacement program. They're recovering some of the cost by breaking up the porcelain and sell it for gardening because people like to have these white little garden things. Interesting idea.
So if you had almost the most important question waiting to be asked, you can always get the panelists on their way, trying to make their way out the door to lunch. And I was going to make one comment just before I turn it back over to Bob Slater, which was that the question was raised about how do we get municipal governments to act in a progressive fashion when it comes to water. And I would say you look at the example of the Good Roads Association, which for 50 years has been getting municipal governments to act in a progressive and foresighted fashion when it comes to roads. There are existing models for how to do this at the municipal level. Bob?
Well, on behalf of you all, let me thank... an excellent end to the morning session. a wonderful taster for lunch, which is to follow right now outside here. And you are requested, absolutely requested, to be in your seats for 1:30. In your seats, sitting, attendant, waiting for the Minister of the Environment, Jim Prentice. Thank you. Excellent.